Hi everyone, welcome to this week's W3C CCG meeting. Today, we are very excited to have my friend Andrew Budd, the founder and CEO of iProof, one of the leading biometric authentication service providers out there, to actually present about biometric authentication. Authentication, as we know, is kind of a linkage between the physical identity and the digital self. And, it is one of the key, technologies, in the identity stack. So very, very glad, to have him here. But before we, get to the main agenda, I just want to go over some, typical admin stuff. So first of all, I just want to, do a quick reminder on the code of ethics and professional conduct. I just want to make sure that, everyone, be respectful and acknowledge each other's different perspectives. I think, we have been doing that quite well in the past years, just wanted to do a quick reminder for that. Another quick note on the intellectual property. Anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributions to the CCG work items must be members of the CCG with full IPR agreements signed. So if you have questions in regards to that or your W3C account, feel free to ping any of the co-chairs. A quick call note, these meetings are being automatically recorded and transcribed. So we try to publish it within the next 24 hours. And the meeting minutes and video recordings are being automatically published typically, but the script has some issues. So I'll manually send it out in the next 24 to 48 hours. We use GG Chat to cue the speakers during the call, as well as to take minutes. So you can type in Q+ to add yourself to the queue and Q- to remove. And I will moderate the queue. All right, time for introductions and reintroductions. So if you're new to the community or you haven't been active and want to re-engage with the community, feel free to just unmute and introduce yourself. All right, any announcements or reminders? Mani, please.
Yeah, in the verifiable credentials working group this week, we are planning to take the BBS cryptography suite to the candidate recommendation phase. That basically means we are done with the design. It's ready for implementation. We already have two independent implementations, which is the minimum required to get the global standard, but clearly we want much more coverage, eyes on it, that sort of thing. So I'll put the BBS crypto suite, CBR spec, that's in the chat channel. So that's the static copy that's going to go to candidate recommendation. We'll see if the vote succeeds this week. If it doesn't, we'll keep trying until it does. So just a heads up to implementers, now would be the time to start implementing. If you haven't already, we will have an interoperability test suite for you to use to demonstrate interoperability with in the next couple of months. That's it for the update.
Thank you, Manu. Thanks a lot. Great. You're next.
I just wanted to say on BBS, I've got example implementations, including all the way through an interoperability server, open source. I will post that to the mailing list, and happy to help anybody who's trying to get implementations together at BBS. Oops, I meant to un.
All right, Manu.
Yeah, sorry, and I realized that what I said might have sounded like word salad to people that don't know what BBS is. BBS is an unlinkable digital signature suite. The reason that it is important for individual privacy is because the way most digital signatures work, if you show something like a digital driver's license online, the digital signature on that's not going to change, which means that it is a tracking cookie. Wherever you use that driver's license online, every single website gets the same identifier. And because of that, people can collude and track you as you go site to site as you use that digital driver's license. Now, if the digital signature that's used uses the BBS cryptography suite, the signature changes for every single site that you use it on, which means that there is no longer, at least in the signature, a digital tracking, you know, cookie token that can be used to correlate you as you work across the web. So if you need to do, you know, things like prove age or things like that, BBS is a pretty good solution. Because you can do it in a way where you can't be tracked online. So that's why people are really interested in the BBS crypto suite. That's it.
Thanks for the amazing explanation. By the way, we had a session on BBS before, I think about 6-7 months ago. I think Greg actually led that discussion. Are there anything new? Should we do an update on the BBS? Greg, please.
Yes, there are some nice enhancements in security, privacy, and usability that have gone into the spec, and there are new features and the progress of the BBS crypto suite. So I'll work with you offline to set up something.
Great. Thank you. Thanks, Greg. I actually really appreciate your presentation last night, especially there was a demo that people can play with that helps us understand how BBS works. So thanks a lot. Mm-hmm. Any other announcements or reminders? All right. Any updates on the work items? So we're still planning to have a session around April to talk about the CCG work items. So if you have any comments or new suggestions on what work items to be added to the CCG, feel free to reach out to any of the co-chairs. We will probably reach out to a lot of people in regards to the updates of existing work items as well. Actually, Will and I had a great call with King Duffy yesterday in regards to the CGG work item. So, yeah, stay tuned. We'll give the community an update, in the next, month or two. All right. Any last calls for introductions, reintroductions, announcements, reminders or work items? All right. So let's get to the main agenda. Again, excited to have Andrew Budd, the founder and CEO of iProve. iProve is actually one of the leading providers for biometric authentication and what's called liveness detection. So it's not just about biometrics. It's also trying to determine whether the person on the other end is alive or not. You know, I actually met Andrew in a conference about 2 months ago, and I thought it's always kind of good to have an expert to actually talk about this. I know biometric authentication has been a controversial topic, especially in the kind of privacy arena. So I think it's good to have an expert here to kind of talk about, and you know, what's true, what are the facts, and what are the myths. Because at the end of the day, you know, you do need to establish the link between the physical and digital self. And personally, I think biometric authentication is one of the key technologies to do that. So without further ado, you know, I'll let Andrew take the stage. And if you have any questions, please add it to the queue, and I will moderate the queue after the presentation. Thanks a lot. Andrew, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much indeed, Harrison, and thank you very much to the group for extending an invitation to talk today. Let me just share my screen so that you can see the slides.
Yep. Just looks good.
Very good. And let's hope that they move forward as required as well. A couple of words about iProve. We're nearly 200 people. We're based in London. We've been in business now for over 10 years. As Harrison said, we focus very much on the area of biometric verification and liveness. Until a few years ago, the whole topic of verifiable credentials was a complete closed book to us. We were the first ever non-US company to secure a contract with the Silicon Valley Innovation Program, the SVIP of the Department of Homeland Security under the tutelage of Anil John. And thanks to Anil, we were introduced to the virtues of verifiable credentials, and in particular the W3C verifiable credentials. And I'm afraid I've adopted them with the enthusiasm of the proselyte. So I'm now a bit of an evangelist for this. I think Harrison will confirm that through one of the trade associations that I'm involved with, the Mobile Ecosystem Forum, I have been evangelizing the power and potential of the W3C verifiable credentials. I'm not, however, a technical expert. So if anything that I say in this presentation regarding verifiable credentials is incomplete or incorrect, then please forgive me. It's marked by enthusiasm rather than malice. Let's just start by talking about the role of authentication. The way that I look at digital identity is that in the end, a digital identity is just a set of facts about a person. These facts are clearly the components that are the certificates that are stored in a wallet. But in general terms, an identity is just a set of facts about people. And the ultimate purpose of digital identity is to enable the creation of trust between two parties to a transaction. And unfortunately, trust is not vested in facts. Trust is vested in the end in the judgments and personality of what goes on inside the human mind, what goes on between people's ears. So no matter how convincing and comprehensive any set of facts in an identity may be, at some point, it is absolutely essential to bind those facts to a real human being. And that is ultimately the task of authentication. And historically, there have been three ways of doing these, and these ways are being combined in multi-factor authentication. There's something you know, passwords getting ever longer, or that are easily brute-forced. We know all the multiple disadvantages are something that you know. In recent years, instead, there's been great enthusiasm for the proxy represented by something that you possess, typically a mobile phone. But there's a problem with mobile phones. This is a street in London, but of course it could be anywhere else. This actually happened to me. I hope you were able to see the person on the bicycle simply snatches the phone out of her hand. And when it happened to me, fortunately, the kid dropped it. So there is a problem with these proxies, which is that they are not indelibly attached to us. The third factor that can be used for authentication is the biometric, something you are, or as the Europeans call it, inherence. Now, there are many biometrics. There can be irises and fingerprints and a whole variety of other things. But ultimately, the most powerful biometric that can be used for identity authentication is face. Why? Well, there are four basic reasons. One is the face is the one thing that already links government-issued identity documents to human beings. So today, the facts that are embodied in a government ID are bound to the individual by means of the face, and in almost all cases, including most passports, for example, and certainly all driving licenses, it's the face. So it's already used for this purpose. It can be captured using a camera, which today all personal devices have, so it's super available, and it's incredibly usable. I look at my device, it looks back at me, nothing could be simpler. So it is uniquely available to everybody who wants it. Like other biometrics, but particularly, it can't be stolen, at least not without a scalpel and a great deal of blood. Very often I hear this question, well, you know, I can reset my passport, but I can't reset my face. That is a category error. A face is not a secret. It's a public document, but it cannot be stolen. It can be copied, and we're going to talk about defending against copies in a minute, but it cannot be stolen. And another great virtue, because it is because of the nature of the biometric itself and the way in which it's captured, i.e. through a front camera, it can be reliably transmitted over the internet and processed on the cloud as well as on the device. So in terms of reach into the population, accessibility, usability, and the flexibility it provides, and its existing track record abuse, the face is absolutely unbeatable. So then the question is, how should biometrics be used in the world of verifiable credentials? And there are really two models that I just want to discuss with you. In one, let's just talk through how biometrics are, the flow of biometrics. Well, clearly, the credential issuer will, in many cases, include biometrics in the process for authentication, during issuance of the credential itself, to ensure that the authorized party is the person requesting the credential, and that in fact it's going into their wallet and not the wallet of some other person, of an impersonator. And typically, the mechanism for doing that very often involves what is called IDV. IDV means capturing an identity document, such as a driving license or a passport, and a face selfie, matching them together and saying, yes, we can be sure that the person that we're hoping is requesting the credential is in all respects physically present when that credential is to be issued. The credential issuer will then issue a photograph into the identity wallet. And then there are two ways in which the verifier can be convinced that the real human being is actually presenting the verifiable presentation. In the model that you're seeing here, the wallet then authenticates the use, and you're very familiar with the idea that users will authenticate on their phone somehow, and typically it might be a phone-based authentication. But as we were saying before, in many cases that either doesn't, that has drawbacks, or it's insufficient for the verifier. The verifier wants to know that the person and not their device proxy is actually the counterparty in their transaction. Therefore, a biometric needs to be tested. And in this case, in the wallet-based model, the biometric authentication is done in, by, or for the wallet, and a credential is issued, which, as I've shown here, might be considered as being a certificate of authenticity. And what the verifier gets is a proof of authenticity, a proof of ownership of a certificate of biometric authenticity. Now, if that's done by a third party, such as iProof, then iProof is the root of trust for that. And the certificate might typically say that this particular DID authenticated its biometric likeness and its genuine presence to a particular level of assurance, in this case, for example, EU level of assurance high, at a particular timestamp. And if that timestamp is sufficiently close to the time of the verification, the verifier can be satisfied that the rest of all the other proofs of credential that are issued at the same time were issued under the control of the authentic user. Now, there are some challenges with this, which we'll talk about in a second. One is, to what level of assurance has that biometric credential actually been checked as far as the verifier is aware? The certificate of authenticity says it's been checked, but unless there's a standard like EU level of assurance high, the risk is that certificate says the DID has authenticated its biometric liveness and genuine presence to some standard of which you're completely unaware, so it might be good and it might be bad, trust us. That's got some problems. So this level of assurance question mark is a big question mark, but the great thing here is that the identity wallet never issues more than a proof of authenticity. As is common in verifiable credentials, there's no obvious mechanism by which the verifier can pay the authentication provider. The second model, which I think many organizations think is going to prevail, is where the verifier does the verification. So in other words, the user authenticates them somehow to themselves to their wallet, but the verifier doesn't trust that. And therefore the identity wallet is requested to provide a photograph to the, and then the verifier uses some form of independent mechanism to assure that the user who is physically present in front of the wallet at that time looks like the certified photograph. So the verifier does the biometric authentication. And if payment has to be done, then the verifier pays the authenticator, such as iProof, and that's all great. And they have a knowledge of the level of assurance because they've got a direct contract with the authenticating body. So you can see that there are these two different models for how biometrics may be used for authentication in a verifiable credential context. And they are irrespective of how iMetrics were used for authentication when the credential was issued. So to summarize how these models are, what you'll immediately see is that the verifier authenticated model really isn't consistent with the way that verifiable credentials have been conceived, because there is a gigantic information leakage. There is a photo, the data that's exchanged in the case of the verifier authenticated model is a signed photograph, which is really excessive as far as the verifier is concerned, if the verifier doesn't actually need to know what the person looks like. They just need to know that they're genuinely there. Whereas in the wallet authenticated model, privacy is very much protected. All that is exchanged is just a certificate of authenticity. So the wallet authenticated model is far more consistent with the privacy model of verifiable credentials. But the problem is there are a number of problems. One is that there's no business model support, because good quality authentication will cost money. And in the verifier authenticated model, there's a way for the verifier to pay for that. And in the wallet authenticated model, there isn't. And that is going to be a problem. And secondly, we've got this issue about level of assurance, that in the verifier authenticated model, the verifier knows who they've contracted with. They know directly and have direct control over the technique that they use to biometrically authenticate the person. And therefore, they can trust that directly. Whereas otherwise, they are dependent upon whatever the wallet tells them about the level of assurance that was used. And the EIDAS 2, the European standard, recognizes this by creating these preset levels, such as level of assurance high, which the verifiers can depend on. And in fact, there's a big discussion going on in Europe at the moment about exactly what level of assurance high means in practice. Now, we've talked about biometrics up until now. And as you're probably aware, there are two models for doing biometrics. There's on-device biometrics and there's cloud biometrics. In cloud biometrics, the biometrics are processed either in part or in whole, not on the device, but in the cloud. And this is a very, very important distinction. It's subject to quite a lot of misunderstandings. The theory is that the theory espoused, for example, and driven by the FIDO Alliance and others who supported it, is that on-device has an enormous advantage because it keeps the biometric template super secret and never allows it off the device. And that's perfectly true. There is a whole question as to whether the biometric template in and of itself has any particular value to an attacker, whether the theft of a biometric template genuinely does compromise the user or not. But I do want to draw the distinction between the biometric templates, that is the matching, we're going to talk about the different phases of biometrics in a second, where the biometric matching takes place and where the liveness takes place. But I want just to point out that doing it on the device has some huge drawbacks. As I showed before, if that kid on the bike snatches the phone out of your hand, you've lost your credentials. And in fact, most of us change our devices reasonably frequently. And again, the credentials are lost and there's a recovery process that has to be done. But if we go more into the technology of it, there's also an issue that an on-device platform is actually a laboratory for attackers to experiment with the technology that is used to protect the security of the biometrics and thereby to find ways of circumventing it. The result is, and this is biometrics are ultimately vulnerable to copies, to forgeries, and therefore biometric verification is fundamentally a fraud detection and prevention system. And the last thing in the world you want is to put a fraud detection and prevention system into the hands of the fraudster, because surprisingly enough, they will find a way to defraud it. The other problem is that the technology that you can run on devices is, generally speaking, not very good. According to a very recent study, 40% of devices can be spoofed by 2D photos. So you can do it on the device, but it probably won't work very well. And insofar as there are security changes that are necessary, you're reliant on the user to act in a responsible way in order to keep themselves safe. And that's not quite fair. There are huge benefits to doing things in the cloud. The obvious one, that you provide multi-channel access and that you can support account recovery. the moment that you put the security system in the cloud, it is inaccessible to attackers. That's not security by obscurity. It just means the attackers have no obvious means of, for example, mounting generative adversarial attacks on these algorithms and thereby cracking them within minutes. It's a very difficult process for them to run any experiments on the attacks, and therefore they're extremely resilient to reverse engineering. The other absolutely fundamental thing, and I'm going to come back to this in a second, is that if you run it in the cloud, you can watch the attacks. If you're looking for them, you can watch the attacks. And watching the attacks is a really crucial requirement if you are to build a system that is resiliently secure and can respond rapidly to a changing attack environment. Let's talk a little bit about what's involved in biometrics. Commonly, when everyone thinks about biometrics, they think about face matching. Face matching is the technology that is obviously used in surveillance applications, but that does not mean that biometric verification has anything to do with surveillance. In fact, we resist the phrase face recognition in anything to do with biometric authentication, because face recognition and face verification are two profoundly different processes. In the case of face recognition, the user knows what's happening, they consent to it, they have agency, they get personal benefit from it, and their privacy is assured. So even though the same technologies of face matching may be used for face recognition and for face verification, the ethics of it and the privacy aspects of them are profoundly different. And I want to make that very clear. The real challenge of biometric verification is not the biometric matching. Let's be very clear. Impersonation attacks are not the threat to biometrics. The likelihood that an attacker is going to go out and find 50,000 people who might just possibly look like, or 100,000 people who, and find in those 100,000 people somebody who might just possibly look a lot like me, is negligible. So it's important to have face matching, but it's not the crux of it. And that is fundamentally, with the evolution of deep learning networks, a solved problem. Many others invest heavily in doing this. We, as iProof, for example, do not charge for the face matching component of biometrics at all, because it is so much easier than everything else that's done in this chain. The next challenge you have to deal with, that has to be dealt with, we talked about copies. The first is copies in the form of artifacts. That is, photographs on iPads, videos and deepfakes on iPads, or masks like this one that my wife absolutely refused to have in the house. This was what was traditionally known as, as presentation attacks. And for a long time, these were regarded as the principal threat to biometric systems. But they're not anymore. Like face matching, this is typically a static problem. That is, the quality of 3D printing is not changing very much. The quality of screens on devices is not changing very much. I do not look any more or less like my neighbor than I did 20,000 years ago. So these two problems are fundamentally static problems, which technology can converge on solving very, very well. But that's not true of the third type of attack, the digital injection attack. In a digital injection attack, there is no camera, and therefore there are no cues arising from putting an artifact in front of a camera. In a digital injection attack, a piece of video, which might be a simple recording replayed, or it might be a piece of synthetic video generated using deepfake, is directly injected into the data stream arising from the user agent. And in that case, there are no camera cues. There are all the metadata can be forged. There are no clues that what you're looking at is anything less than perfect. And this is a technology which is not static. This is changing at an incredible rate, and I'll talk about that some more in a second. So the key issue here is that for a long time, the attention initially was focused upon face matching because it didn't work, but it works beautifully now, so it's not an issue. Then a lot of attention focused upon presentation attacks. And today people still qualify their liveness solutions by reference to a commercial organization that runs attacks using masks. But fundamentally, that is what I would describe as a legacy attack mode. The real attack mode that the bad guys are using are digital injection attacks. And let's talk about how you defend, and we'll come back to that some more, but let's talk about how you defend against these attacks, the different types of liveness defense. And really, of course, like any good technology, it's a 4x4. On the left-hand side, the question is some sort of user action required? So you can ask the user to blink or turn their head or read words or hold something up, or you can make it passive, that the user doesn't have to do anything at all. That they just look at their device, the device looks back at them, and it's done. Or that there's something which is so intuitive that no written instructions are necessary. And then there are methods. On the left, you can try to determine liveness by looking for a repeated biometric signal. And by definition, a repeated biometric signal is predictable. Or you can introduce unpredictable, one-time, non-repeated biometric signals into the flow. Now, clearly, and interestingly enough, the world started at the bottom left. So in the early days of biometrics, typically the way that liveness was established was by getting users to blink. That was certainly one of the principal ways. So you had to tell the user to do something, and they did it every time. The result was that so there are two things. One is, if you ask people to do things, then you get higher cognitive demand. You have to give people written instructions to do things. And as a major government agency once told us, we have to assume that some of our users have a reading age of 9 years old. And they have to be respected. So it's important from an accessibility point of view that you make the cognitive demand as low as possible. And therefore, things that require user actions are not great from a cognitive demand point of view, they're not great from an accessibility point of view, and they're not good from a conversion rate point of view. So you really want to move towards a world in which there are no user action required, because that way you get higher conversion rates, but also higher accessibility. More people in the population can succeed. So it's driven really by the needs of users and the needs of the use case. As I've said, the predictable repeated biometric signal has been a very popular way of doing things. In recent years, we've moved from user blinking to no user action, where single frame liveness, API based liveness was used. The user didn't have to do anything. You take a snap of a single selfie of a person and you chuck it back in the API, and that API would magically tell you whether what you were looking at was real or not. The problem is that when you're dealing with deepfakes, which look extremely real, and in fact, or replays or photo or digital images of people, there's nothing in the biometric that tells you that they are not real. And therefore, you are completely reliant upon the device, upon device side defenses to prevent injection attacks being submitted. So a lot of systems today put code into the SDKs on users' devices in an attempt to try to detect whether the image flow has been subverted, whether the camera's feed has been changed, whether there are signals that the camera that is being used is not a real camera. So code is on the device, and the only people who can read the code is anybody who can download the SDK. So in other words, all attackers have access to the SDKs and can, if they're able to, reverse engineer it, find out what the defense system is looking for, and then subvert it. The defense against that is very often code obfuscation. And code obfuscation can be quite effective, but as is quite clear out in the market, it's not universally effective. With a certain amount of effort, code obfuscation can be overcome. So any system that only has device-reliant defenses, it is likely will be breached by attackers who can reverse engineer the SDKs and thereby subvert the device-reliant defenses. And that's why there has been an increasing move in recent years to unpredictable, to systems that augment the device-reliant defenses with imagery-based defenses. That is, that introduce these unpredictable one-time challenges into the scene itself, in the expectation that whilst they can perhaps be forged, they can't be forged very well. And therefore, you see people reading out, people being asked to read out words or numbers that are one time and non-repeating, or the use of controlled illumination from the screen of the device, and I'll show you an example of that in a minute, in which the user is illuminated in a unique way each time, which cannot be predicted. So what we're seeing, driven by the needs for inclusion and high conversion rates, and driven by the increasing sophistication of biometric attacks, we're seeing an evolution from the bottom left to the top right. How do we know some of this? Well, many liveness and biometric solutions are just what we, many years ago we would have just described as a disk. It's a piece of software that a relying party runs on their servers, unmonitored, unmanaged, and effectively running blind. But like any fraud protection system, you can't expect that to have any durable security. So modern systems, and I don't shy away from saying that this is a fundamental part of what we at IPOOP do, actively look at and monitor everything that is happening on all the platforms that are running liveness worldwide, look for weak signals of attacks, detect them, analyze the attack sources, analyze the attack patterns and methodologies, seek to reproduce them, learn in real time from the visibility that is gained as to what's actually happening out in the wild, and generate new classifiers and new defenses to respond to these attacks as and when they happen, so that as and when new vulnerabilities become apparent, they can be responded to and closed up before they become systemic. And this, we think, is absolutely fundamental to making biometrics work, because if you can't see these changing attacks on liveness, you don't know what you're trying to defend against and you can't respond to them. Now, that, of course, gives a very high degree of visibility into what attackers are actually doing out in the market. And it makes it possible to build a taxonomy of attacks based upon what people are actually doing out in the market. I won't talk you through this. It's very complicated. You'll have a chance to look at this in the recording later. But as you can see, there's a complex taxonomy of different kinds of biometric attacks, all of which are used to try to copy, to try to succeed in providing copies of people's faces undetected. Let's, on the basis of our observations, let me just share with you some four trends that we're seeing in the market. The first is that face swaps have become the absolute attack of choice amongst the persistent threat actors. And what happens is that there is actually a human being on the other side of the real camera, but the face of the human being is, as you can see on the right, convincingly changed, a victim or that of a non-existent person, in order to conceal the face of the attacker. I defy anybody in this meeting or who's watching this video to be able to determine which of these faces is the genuine face. The great thing about these methods is that they give total control to the threat actor, so any action that is required of them they can do. They're incredibly scalable. As you can see, the quality is now incredibly perfect. They are a huge threat, not just to biometric systems, but to the alternative to biometric systems that are currently widely used in many parts of the world, especially in Europe, which is video ident systems, where identity is supposed to be established, particularly during the credential issuance phase, by having a video call between the subject and an agent. It's thought that if the agent can see the person at the other end of the line, and that they're able to do a Zoom or Skype call or whatever it is that they're using, and that they look like the person on their document, then they're probably good, and that time is absolutely over. And to give you a sense for how fast this is moving, we saw out in the wild an increase of 700% in 6 months of 2023. This method of attack went from being a rather specialized thing to absolutely exploding. And the reason is that there are free attack tools available to do this. We've seen, again, in 2023, we saw a rapid change in the kinds of attacks that are being mounted on mobile platforms. So in 2022, attacks were typically mounted on the relatively vulnerable web platforms. In 2023, we saw the shift move to the much harder mobile platforms. So on the left, you can see the incredible growth in attacks on mobile web. And on the right, you can see the attacks mounted on native mobile apps using Android emulators, mostly Android, some iOS emulators, but Android emulators, which completely bypass the device-side defenses, the obfuscated camera switch detection software, which I talked about previously, because there is no camera switch, because there is no camera, because it's all an emulator. And there's a growing variety of different solutions there, and you can see these rapidly increasing bursts of attacks that took place with increasing intensity towards the back end of 2023. So you can see this is, and you can see it's growing exponentially. So something very violent is happening out in the market at the moment, threatening mobile platforms as well as computer web-based platforms. What we're seeing now is also a change in the way in which the attackers mount these attacks. In the old days, people would typically bounce in, they'd spend a couple of days trying to attack something. If they didn't succeed, they'd go away again. That has completely changed now. Now we're seeing incredibly aggressive attacks lasting 2 months or more, with, in one case, over 1,000 threat actors engaging in an attack. Think about it, over 1,000 threat actors mounting these sustained types of attack. In the emulator case, spoofing the metadata completely. So this is the change in the dynamics of this has been dramatic and quite disturbing. And finally, what we're seeing is the growth in threat groups engaged in the exchange of information. This is no longer individual attackers going after trying it on with biometric systems. We're seeing threat groups with a median value of 1,000 members. 1,000 members in these groups. And there are hundreds and hundreds of these threat groups. Half of them were created in 2023. So this is a huge new development that is happening now. A number of groups like this doubled, and it's growing now even faster. So this is no longer a hobby. This is a large scale professional cybersecurity attack sequence method being mounted against biometric systems. Now, is there any defense against them? Well, let me just show you what a zero effort, unpredictable solution that is so far resilient to these kinds of threat actors look like. So, here we have, this is, as I said, controlled illumination. This is the light from the screen illuminating the person in a non-predictable way. This is what it looks like from a user point of view. She lines her face up, and the screen flashes an unpredictable one-time sequence of colors onto her face. This is something that the attacker cannot foresee, and therefore they have to improvise in real time. They are trying to improvise it. They're just yet not yet very good at it. The question is, how on earth is it possible to evaluate the effectiveness of this fraud defense technology critical to biometric authentication, known as liveness? And it's a huge problem at the moment. There are really four approaches. One is private test houses who work with national security bodies to try and look at new ways of doing this. So Ingenium, for example, was set up by ex-people from the British Defence and Intelligence Community. CETA is based at a university in upstate New York. And these are people who are trying to push the boundaries at the moment of testing in a systematic way against the new threats. But of course, what they're trying to do is to find repeat ways. It's what they're used to doing, although in the future that's going to change, is providing repetitive ways of testing a system that is designed to respond dynamically to repetitive ways. So there's a real tension there, and the result of dealing with that tension is that the alternative that many governments have done is to actually build skilled red teams and try to act as attackers do. So one example was a US federal intelligence contractor called AIS, who were commissioned by the Department of Homeland Security SBIP team to spend 3 months, a team of eight people spending 3 months attacking Aliveness system using deepfakes to try to not so much determine whether it was a vulnerability or invulnerability, but the level of effort required to succeed and the durability of any such vulnerabilities that might or might not have been determined. The third point is actually to say that what matters is not even the specific technology, whether it's flashing lights or movement or whatever, but what are the business processes that create adaptability? What are the business processes that observe, learn, and respond that create the resilience, the visibility and the resilience that I was talking about before? And so you have in Europe the EIDAS standard, where a number of auditors, notably TUV Sud, have pioneered methods of auditing these business processes to make sure that they reach the highest levels of assurance. In the case of e-signatures, known as qualified trust services, and in the case of EID, level of assurance high. And they look at the technology and how the technology has been assessed, but they look to the business processes that deliver practically that resilience over time. And this is where I think is a very promising method that is going to grow over time. And finally, there are those who can't afford any of these things and simply rely upon the decisions and the evaluations made by major organizations such as these customers of ours, who have taken the trouble to make levels of effort and sustainability and resilience of security. In one of these cases, a security evaluation took 12 months. Well, not many people can pay for that, but once it's done, third parties can rely upon it. So to wrap up, in leaving time for questions, what do we believe? Well, we believe that in future, users will authenticate their faces to their own wallets. I think that the privacy and model compliance requirements of the verifiable credential, of the decentralized identity movement, will militate in favor of authenticate to model one, as I showed earlier. That is where people authenticate to their own wallets, and what the verifier gets is nothing more than a certificate of authenticity. We are completely convinced that identities will be underpinned by cloud-based biometrics, because device-based biometrics will neither have the flexibility nor the resilience to deliver the level of security that decentralized identity will require. We think that biometric authentication will rely wholly upon liveness defenses, and that pretty much the only thing that will matter will be liveness defense against injected deepfakes. That will become the root of trust for verifiable credentials. It's going to be a challenge, which we're going to have to address, as to how that level of trust, what is written in that certificate that means that the verifier can trust that the liveness check that's been done has been done well enough. And I wanted to leave you this this is perhaps the most critical message that I want to leave you with. Only those biometric authenticators, those liveness providers who actually have visibility of the attacks and are able to react quickly to attacks will be in a position to sustainably and resiliently defend against them. Everyone else will end up being compromised, and that compromise will have a dramatically negative effect upon the level of trust that users will have in biometrically assured credentials and, frankly, in decentralized identities altogether. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Andrew. This is a great presentation. Actually, even better than the one that I saw about two years ago. So thank you. Any questions? I will be moderating the queue. Manu, please.
Yeah, Andrew, fantastic presentation. Just wonderful stuff. It was eye-opening to see all the different types of attacks that, at least in my mind, were a year or two out, and you're saying they're happening, you know, right now. And I think, you know, the thing that many of us, you know, are thinking about now is the irrational exuberance about what AI can do. Some of that's coming true faster than most other things. Do you feel like we're going to get to a point with generative AI where even the live, you know, detection, things like, you know, the changing of colors on screens where we may not be able to depend on individuals' devices anymore to not inject, you know, generative AI feeds? Are we headed towards a future where there has to be trusted hardware out at the edge? What do you think, you know, how do you think this stuff scales given that generative AI is going?
I mean, there are two questions there, Manu. We can't trust the devices now. But what's very clear is that as of now, we are seeing tens of thousands of injected deepfakes coming in now from users' devices. So one way or another, either the user's device has been compromised or the user devices were never genuine. They're forged user devices. They've been compromised in some way or another. And therefore, we don't believe. Today, we're already at the stage where you cannot trust a user device. The deepfakes are coming in from what look like genuine user devices. So in that sense, we're already. Then the question is, will it be possible in future to defend against deepfakes? We have one huge advantage, and that is an information asymmetry. Providing that we have this visibility that I said was so crucial, we learn more about the attack. On every attack, we learn more about the attackers than they learn about us. That information asymmetry is absolutely fundamental because it enables us, and when I say us, I don't mean necessarily just iProof. I mean the sophisticated liveness defense community. It enables us to learn from the attackers more rapidly than they learn from us and to adapt ourselves to their new techniques. I had a letter published in The Economist a few weeks ago in which I said, if we set the tune that the AI has to dance to, we can spot when it stumbles. And that's this question about injecting unpredictable elements into the scene forces the AI to do things that are not natural to it, that are not trained on billions of data points, and therefore that they will make imperceptible mistakes in. They don't know what imperceptible mistakes are, but we can learn. And as long as we can continue forcing them to make imperceptible mistakes and we can learn from their responses, then I think there is a reasonable likelihood, a good likelihood, that we'll continue to stay ahead as generative AI gets better and better and better and better.
So I have a follow-up question, Andrew. When you talked about inserting an unpredictable element or action, like such as a control illumination, the way I kind of think of it is kind of like adding a cryptographic salt to actually defend against rainbow attacks. Okay, so that analogy is true.
Exactly. Okay. It's a very good analogy, yes.
So if that analogy is true, then I'm just curious, like, what do you foresee are for fraudsters to kind of counter that approach, because, or is this problem like basically solved, like using basically this cryptographic salt to defend against? Is the problem basically solved, or do you foresee fraudsters coming up with new schemes and what those new schemes are?
Cryptographic models are not quite right when thinking about biometrics, because cryptography is very deterministic and there are good measures of difficulty in solving these problems. Biometrics are very much more complex and very much more probabilistic. So I think it would be quite wrong to say that it's solved. What we've done is by adding this salt, we've increased the level of difficulty. The fraudsters are attempting all the time to produce better and better forgeries. We are continuing to introduce more and more unpredictable elements. This is a continuous cat and mouse race. It's a little bit like antivirus, frankly. There are many analogies between liveness detection and antivirus detection. If you can watch what's going on, you can respond to the latest virus. You can never say we have definitively made devices safe against viruses. What you can say is you continue to maintain a high barrier. And that barrier is going to have to get higher and higher. People sometimes ask us, what's our company strategy? I say it's a little bit like asking a hamster on a wheel, what's your strategy? And the answer is just, you know, as the wheel runs faster and faster, the answer is stay where we are. But there is a reason, there are good reasons to think that that is going to continue to be feasible. But the key to this is visibility. The key to this is monitoring what's going on, watching the attacks so that the defender is in a position to respond to them rapidly. You know, one of the issues that we've got in this industry is that there's a myth of invulnerability, that somehow that the world is divided into live systems that can never be fooled and live systems that can be fooled. That is just wrong. There is no cybersecurity system that is invulnerable. And anybody who thinks they're invulnerable just hasn't detected the vulnerability. The key issue is, what is the level of effort required to find a vulnerability, and what is the lifetime of the vulnerability once the attacker has discovered it? And that's a mental shift that we have to get the industry to make.
Great. Thank you. Well, we'll take one last question. Brandy. Brandy, I think you're on mute.
Sorry. So that actually segues great into my question. Andrew, thank you for the presentation. That was fabulous and very interesting. So I'm thinking that your business model is based on a decrease in fraud, right? So what's our target in terms of decreasing fraud, and how does that play into the decentralization, centralization conversation that you hit on early on in your presentation with the how liveness will be verified by the wallet or the verifier?
I'm not sure I understood your question, Brandy, but let me take a shot at what I think I understood. I think you're asking what's the business model. Today our business model is substantially based upon either per transaction or per user charging. So we may charge X per authentication, or we may charge Y per user per month. And that's the challenge is the one person that we know is not going to pay is the user. So business models in which somehow mysteriously the wallet owner is going to pay money, I think are completely wrong. Everybody knows that the business, at least everybody I've spoken to, believes that the revenue value flows in this ecosystem are going to come from the verifier. And therefore, there is a challenge for how to make money, how to make value flow from the verifier to the authenticator, whoever they are, even if the authenticator is issuing certificates into the wallet. But frankly, that's a business model challenge that the whole verifiable credential community has, because, of course, there are a bunch of other forms of certificate issuers, like the qualified trust service providers who issue all sorts of certificates and want to be paid for it. And they typically would like to be paid ultimately by the verifiers. So there is a generalized business model problem in this industry, and we participate in that. But yes, I mean, to do the job that we do requires a very substantial amount of compute for each transaction. I mean, we have scores of classifiers working to look for copies, and it requires an enormous amount of research and development. I mean, we don't employ nearly 200 people for our health. You know, this is a hard problem, and it takes a lot of effort to stay ahead of the attackers, many of whom, and I want to just remind you of this, can be national state actors. They can be hostile state actors, motivated by reasons which transcend even criminal gain. So the resources that are being applied to the attacks can be, in many cases, absolutely enormous. And therefore, the resources that have to be applied to the defense are material, and those have to be remunerated. And the way we remunerate, as I say, is per transaction or per user. Does that answer your question, Brandy?
If I can tag on, I probably should have said value proposition. I'm looking for your opinion on how much we can actually limit to fraud.
That's a very good question. I won't give a precise number, but the number of successful spoofs that iProof's controlled illumination system experienced last year was in the range 0 to 10. Okay? And that includes 0. I don't want to be specific about the number for a variety of reasons. But that's in a volume of transactions that sometimes reached 1 million a day.
That's amazing.
So the answer is it can work very well. We're sometimes asked, you know, what's the volume of attacks? In reality, the volume of attacks that we experience can be on most users, not all, but most users is relatively low. But that's a bit like saying, if you've got a big armored door at the entrance to your house, do you measure the threat, given that you're living in a pretty dangerous neighborhood, by the number of people who try to break in? No, because pretty quickly the bad guys realize that your door is very solid and there's no point in breaking in, and therefore nobody tries to break in. But the fact that nobody tries to break in doesn't mean that you're living in a safe neighborhood. It means that the attackers have realized that you have strong defenses and go elsewhere. So it's a common misconception that the amount of fraud that you are defending against is the amount of fraud that is mounted against you and fails. And it isn't. We were brought into an enormously intense fraud environment a few years ago, in which attackers had already stolen $20 billion, and we were switched on. And on the day one, we saw an incredible intensity of attacks, and over a period of 6 weeks, those attacks dwindled away to nothing. Because the attackers, and that did not mean at the end of 7 weeks that the fraud risk was nil, it just means the attackers had gone away. The fraud risk initially was intense, but when the attackers realize that this is a hard target, they go and focus elsewhere. So it's actually very difficult to measure what the undeterred fraud threat is. All we can do is judge by proxies, by the number of attackers who wander in and mount a major league attack. And we recently had one against one of our customers where suddenly we started ending up, we suddenly out of nowhere, over 1,000 attack devices started mounting thousands of attacks a day. And this went on for over a week. And then they went away again. So the residual fraud level that can be accomplished is outstandingly low. That I can tell you from our experience and the experience of our customers. But if you're doing a Bayesian analysis, you've got to kind of measure in order to calculate that, you'd have to know what the propensity of, to attack is. And that's actually quite difficult to measure, but it's high and growing. That's what we observe.
Fabulous. Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew. And by the way, just want to add on, Spokio actually got a huge attack late last year in regards to card testing. So it's a little bit different, like credit card testing. And the volume at the highest is 100,000K in that particular day. So yeah, it is a real thing. It's not a hypothetical scenario. So yeah, fortunately, we were able to kind of detect it early and then they went away. But I think they probably just went to attack other companies that has a lesser security proof. So yeah.
That's exactly what we see. That is precisely the behavior that we see.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you. Thanks, Andrew. This is a very, very great presentation, and thanks for taking the time to present here at W3CCG. And if anybody missed this great presentation, we'll publish the recording later this week. So thanks a lot.
Thank you very much for giving me the chance to talk to you. It's been a pleasure.
Great. All right, this concludes this week's CCG meeting. So thanks, everyone. Thanks for attending.
Thank you. Nice meeting you. Bye-bye.